Welcome to the Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are your hosts, Ben Yanowitz
and Zach Smarin. This week we're joined by Becca Strober, an Israel-Palestine-based educator that specializes in showing American and Israeli Jews the reality of Israel's military occupation on the ground and online through her Instagram at becca.explains.the.occupation.
As an American Israeli doing critical educational organizing and co-resistance activism, Becca makes a clear case for the importance of her work and that of the wider, though relatively small, Israeli-Palestine solidarity movement. Through our conversation, it became clear that the global movements for justice in Palestine should be more open to nuance, especially when approaching the questions of Jews seeking to leverage their privilege to aid in dismantling the system of Jewish supremacy that reigns across the land.
Becca clearly has experience presenting her perspectives in confrontational environments, a skill that likely comes from her years of doing this work. If we are to grow our movements and transform our communal spaces, we must be ready to reach out to those who are not yet with us, even if it sometimes feels impossible. This is the only way to uproot people's psychological dependence on Zionism.
We also can't simply fall into a binary diaspora-Israel paradigm. Although the settler colonial projects on both sides of the Green Line are primarily driven by local actors, American Jews represent a substantial base for the ongoing settlement movements. It's vital that we address the conditions that drive these movements, educate our communities as to their inherent violence, and imagine new, harmonious forms of self-determination rooted in the places Jews live.
If you like the work we are doing here, please follow us on Instagram at the Jewish Diasporist Pod, subscribe to our collective YouTube Hamotzi network, and share your episodes with your friends and communities.
In addition, please consider supporting us on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. Thank you to all of those who are already supporting us, and we'd like to especially thank Benjamin Tice, our number one Patreon supporter. Ben and people like him help make this show possible and stay on the air.
Without further ado, we hope you enjoy our conversation.
Becca, it's so wonderful for you to join us. Really looking forward to this conversation. Part of how we understand diasporism is that it emerges primarily out of a focus on family histories as opposed to like a grand national historical narrative. So to begin, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself and perhaps about your family background and how it might inform your current work?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, thanks for inviting me, and I'm really happy to be here and really excited to be in conversation with you. So I was born and raised in Philadelphia, or in a suburb of Philly is more accurate. But I was raised to a family who, amongst other places, is from Jerusalem. Like a fair amount of my family today lives in Jerusalem. And that was a really huge part of my upbringing. And I would say that when I was growing up really in between these two worlds of progressive reform Judaism in Philly. And a lot of the messages that I took from that were things like tikkun olam, right? Like fixing the earth or fixing the world, and kind of social justice and those aspects of Judaism that I really connected with. I also think it really gave me an appreciation of what it means to be a minority in a place without kind of comparing how being a Jewish minority is different from maybe being a different type of minority in the US. But I think it definitely was clear that I was a Jewish person living in a Christian state. And I think that Judaism helped me to navigate that reality early on and really in some ways gave me a political identity. And I would say that a lot of the things that today people talk about as being democratic, you know, like things like social justice or things like having strong checks and balances, things like having minority rights. To me, first and foremost, I learned those through the lens of Judaism. And that was incredibly important to me. My dad was the was the president of our synagogue for a while. It's called Rodef Shalom. And it's like this huge synagogue in Philly. It's not far from the center city. And today it's in a predominantly black neighborhood. I think actually today it's going through gentrification, but when I was growing up, it was in a predominantly black neighborhood. But of course, this is this huge synagogue that had been built like 100 something years earlier. And at the time, it had been a Jewish neighborhood. And the synagogue is so grand that it didn't necessarily move with the community. And so that was also like a big part of understanding Jewish life for me, is that Jewish life is in this greater context of life outside of the synagogue as well. On the flip side of it, on the Jerusalem side of my family, I grew up on stories of Jabotinsky and of revisionist Zionism. My family came over to Israel in 1809. They were some of the kind of Ashkenazi Jews who came over with the Gaon of Vilna, or like with the message of the Gaon of Vilna. And so my family is one of the earlier Ashkenazi communities in Jerusalem, also one of the first families, Ashkenazi families, to settle outside of the old city walls. And so Jerusalem is very, very important to my family. And there's a real Jerusalem identity. Even though I wasn't, raised there, born there, I always had the identity of a Jerusalemite. And I think it's really interesting when you talk to my family today, a lot of my family is are ideological settlers. I've spent my fair share of like Passover in like the settlement of Kdumim. And it wasn't because it was cheaper to live there. It's because my family actively believes in settling the full land of Israel. But I also have family members who the center is Jerusalem, and actually the question of, Jewish sovereignty in the land is not a given to them. Their connection to Jerusalem is a given, right? No one can ever take away Jerusalem. But the question of sovereignty is actually much, much more open. And, but I kind of grew up on stories of how in the my family joined like the Etzel and the Lehi, like the more violent pre-state militias, before the founding of the state. And that's like absolutely, this part of this heroic stories that I grew up on, right? That like, and it was both a question of Jewish safety, but it also was a pride of we helped create sovereignty. And so what I kind of grew up on was these really mixed messages that was like, be in Jerusalem. It's funny, I don't live in Jerusalem today, but I still have the identity. But kind of like be in Jerusalem. And also I still always had that kind of more reform progressive, what I grew up with from my synagogue voice saying, but anywhere you are, you need to make sure that place is just. And so when I was 18, I moved to Israel. And I think it was a combination of reasons. A lot of it had to do with just my family. A lot of my cousins were enlisting in the army or had just finished their service around then. And I think that also, as someone who was kind of between worlds, the idea of going to college as an American felt really individualistic at the moment. It's not that I felt not ready, but it didn't feel like where I was in terms of my own exploration. And like my own kind of like religious identity and my personal identity. And so at 18, I moved to Israel and I've been living here ever since. I'd obviously been to the country before. I even spent a semester abroad in Israel when I was 17. But now it's been half of my life here. I'm 36 today, so it's been literally half of my life. And really kind of went through the process of the identity always existed, but I mean, obviously it really strengthened. And I served in the army. Today I'm obviously very critical of the occupation. But for me, I think a lot of the reasoning for coming was a combination of, what I think most people today would call Zionism, but also just a really strong connection to my family. And, once you move to Israel, joining the army is a part of it. And I wasn't critical of that. Meaning it was something that I wanted to do, I was happy to do. There's this like poem in Hebrew that's kind of like about getting the state on a silver platter. It's really famous, kind of like how dare you take the state on a silver platter? We all have to give our part. And that as a 17-year-old really, really spoke to me. So I think that like my politics have changed a lot, but my upbringing also gave me a lot of the tools from both sides that I have until today. With obviously a more critical lens.
So you moved to Israel around 2006, is that correct?
2007, yeah.
2007. So that's in a very tumultuous period, or right after a very tumultuous period of the Second Intifada. What was that initial movement like? I mean, this is the time when it's before Netanyahu comes back to power after his first premiership, and there's a lot of feeling that the peace process failed, it's dead. We don't really know exactly what to do, but it's also not exactly sure what the future will hold, I believe. I was 5, 6 years old, so I wouldn't know entirely. But and it's also depending on, on 2007, the time period before the real first Gaza war that breaks out with Operation Cast Lead. So what was the feeling like for you? How did you personally experience that at the time of moving?
Yeah, so first of all, I'll say that when I did, it was before I moved here, but when I did a semester in Israel, it was right after the disengagement from Gaza. So the disengagement had already happened. I think that I was in Israel when the initial Hamas PA elections happened. So there was a lot of uncertainty around that. You could still see a lot of people, especially around Jerusalem, having kind of ribbons with orange on it, which was the anti-disengagement movement. And so I was really kind of thrown into learning about all of this in one moment. I don't think that I even knew the disengagement happened until I went to Israel abroad that semester. It was just kind of off my radar, right? It wasn't the type of, I didn't have a real political knowledge of what was going on here. And by the way, when on that same program was the first time, considering I grew up in progressive reform Judaism that constantly talked about a two-state solution, it was only at the age of 17 that I saw a map with the green line on it for the first time. It was only at the age of 17 I had an idea of where this other state is supposed to be. And I look back on that and I think that that is a real failure of the education that I got. And I think today, I do a lot of work with the Jewish diaspora and I think it's gotten somewhat better, but there's still a lot of examples of this. And with Israelis, it's gotten worse. Meaning, I regularly meet Israelis today who are in their late 20s who have never seen a map with the green line.
No, it's just something that on one hand you see sometimes people within the mainstream Jewish communal positions on criticizing Palestinians for using a outline of the entire territory of the former mandate as somehow being an eliminationist agenda towards, I don't know, believing that this somehow displaying that map is equivalent with kicking out all Jews to the sea. Meanwhile, you go into a mainstream communal synagogue, you will very often find a map that very clearly does not have any borders on it, a map by the JNF or any
Oh,
other
yeah.
sort of institution. And when you point out that, that's considered like, oh, well, that doesn't matter in any sort of
Well, that
particular
just
way. Yeah,
is.
that's just, what you want to expect.
Right. Actually, today, most of the work that I do is with Israelis. And I do a lot of work with young Israelis who are 18, 19, often before they enlist in the military. And often I'm meeting them in places like Hebron. I mean, I'm meeting them in the West Bank. And I before have given these 18-year-olds a map of the full land of Israel, or the full land of Israel, like from the river to the sea, and said, draw for me Gaza, draw for me the West Bank, and draw me Hebron. Don't look at each other's work, just draw. I get something like a 4 to 5% success rate. I mean, Israelis do not know where the West Bank is. It's often drawn on the other side of the river, which is funny because it's from the river to the sea. It's often drawn in the Arava, like down more, or is much, much smaller than people think. Gaza tends to be like fairly accurate. Sometimes I would say the main issue with Gaza is that its proportions are overdone, but fine. Like no, we're not like map makers here.
I mean, it's like that place in the little
Right,
corner, right?
exactly. But not that is absolutely not the case with the West Bank. And so Recently, there was a decision by Meta, by Facebook, if From the River to the Sea should be considered anti-Semitic without the line that comes under it, just From the River to the Sea. And someone asked me to write a response, kind of giving my opinion if I think it should be considered anti-Semitic or no. And so I brought in all of my educational experience with Israelis and then also showed a bunch of examples of maps for products that were being marketed on Facebook that had the river to the sea in Hebrew and said, look, you guys show it. Do you think it's anti-Semitic when you are highlighting this schnitzel from the river to the sea? Do you think it's anti-Semitic when it's Yad Shtayim, this kind of like real estate group that made a joke about the river to the sea that Jews can buy property anywhere? And just the reality is that, you know, the point that I tried to make is that Israelis only know the river to the sea. We live in a one-state reality, right? So how can it be anti-Semitic when Palestinians are saying it, but not problematic when Jewish Israelis are saying it? Either we need to kind of expand how we're looking at the situation, or we need to recognize that we only find it a problem because Palestinians are talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to the actual reality on the ground, especially when you're going between Israel 48 and the seam zone, I believe is the correct term. Yes, there's no like transition even sign a lot of the times. It's less marking that you have between state borders in the European Union in the Schengen area or within states within the US. So it's just completely erased in that sense. The green line in many ways does not exist on the ground as any sort of visible practice. In terms of just going back to something a little bit earlier that we mentioned, because this connection between, or the idea of Jerusalem, we've covered it a little bit before with Hadar Cohen. It's quite interesting as well that there's an argument to be made that in terms of Jewish connection to the land of Palestine and Jewish travel and immigration to it before the Zionist movement itself. There's an argument to be made that in some ways Yiddish, that was the language of Ashkenazi immigrants to Palestine for many centuries before the Zionist movement, has more of a claim towards indigeneity as not being connected to a settler colonial project than Hebrew is. There was this whole exploration of Palestinian Yiddish last year that YIVO, the institute, got involved with, but that's in sort of the kind of labels that we can adopt for these things that is not necessarily doesn't necessarily have to be the priority.
It made me think how still, of course, now I don't remember the phrasing, and maybe one of you know, but like that there are Palestinians who sell like trucks of used goods, like Arab Israelis selling trucks of used goods in Jaffa. I live on a moshav near the airport that people will come into the moshav selling stuff, and it's a bunch of random stuff. It'll be like a fridge, but also like a window, whatever. And the phrase that they scream out is Yiddish. It's not Hebrew and it's not Arabic, it's Yiddish. So there's definitely like some remnant of that. But actually, my family, to my knowledge, my family spoke Yiddish, but my family also spoke Arabic, and I think also spoke like some sort of Ladino dialect as well, which I don't know. My family is the Rivlin family. They're like a pretty established family. The former president, the president of Israel before this president, Ruby Rivlin, his mom and my grandmother were sisters, right? And Ruby's dad, who was also a Rivlin, like you know, I mean, like if we go back far enough, we've all married our cousins. If we go back in the family tree, and so did they. So they were both Rivlins. But his dad was the first, I believe, person to translate the Tanakh into Arabic. I think of like so my family definitely has had a lot of different traditions that I think Jerusalem kind of created. And I don't know that there's a the story goes that my family is Sephardic, but I don't know if it's true. Like I've never done we've never done a DNA test. I'm not necessarily interested in it, but we are like Ashkenazis who eat kitniot on Passover. Right. So I do think that there's something to be said about the fact that Jewish communities that were here before the Zionist movement and before the, and definitely before the founding of the state, but even before the movement or before the movement really grew, I think had a lot more linguistic and traditional diversity than what we tend to see today. I'm not an expert on it by any means, but that's kind of my experience with my own family is you kind of have a mix of these different things. And one, the last thing I'll say about this, because it still blows my mind, is today when you think about Ashkenazi and Mizrahi relations in the country, you know, Ashkenazis are thought to be the really powerful ones. But the stories that I always grew up with in Jerusalem was that the Ashkenazi community in Jerusalem in those days were completely dependent on the Sephardic community, including a lot of times monetarily in Hebron in Jerusalem. And it's really interesting to see how things have developed much differently, and a lot of this history is not really talked about, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really important to think about the dynamics of the pre-Zionist Jewish community. I think it's really interesting that your family is, in a way, arguably like Zionist aristocracy, and then you've kind of gone in a different direction with your own politics. And it's really interesting that you were raised between like Reform Judaism and its sort of universal social justice values, and then like what is objectively settler colonial Zionism, revisionist Zionism, fascist Zionism. And the fact that you've navigated these things and in a way that I think like some left-wing anti-Zionist Jews would still not be entirely comfortable with, like using the word Arab-Israeli rather than like Palestinian citizen of Israel. Some would say, oh, that's like normalizationist language or something, or even sit calling it Eretz Yisrael but can become contentious. And I was wondering how you choose to approach the labels that you use. I've noticed that on your podcast, you describe yourself as an Israeli, but you also like were born in Philadelphia. So I was kind of wondering if you could say a little bit about the language you use and why you choose to use the terminology that you do.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So actually, usually I say Palestinian citizen of Israel, but then I think that like now that I've been doing a lot, like since I've started the Instagram and it's been a year now, there's a lot of people who follow me who are Jewish and there's a lot of Israelis who follow me, but there's also a lot of people who have not necessarily a lot of background. And while I think Palestinian citizen of Israel is kind of the more correct term to use because when it comes to the occupation, the state is trying to erase their Palestinian identity. A lot of people get really confused as to who Palestinian citizens of Israel are. And so then sometimes I'll say Arab citizens of the country, sometimes I'll say Arab Israelis. And because it's not my identity, I kind of use a bit of a mix fairly interchangeably. I have a lot of friends who would be really upset by any of the labels that does that they don't think applies to them, you know? And so that's even like a really good example of me just kind of really unsure sometimes and switching it up or not necessarily sticking to one thing. Yeah, I call. So I think if you look at my page and I have like an introduction onto who I am, and I say that I'm Israeli American. And sometimes I think I used to maybe put the American before the Israeli. Now I put the Israeli before the American. I'm not really sure, but I definitely don't try and shy away from the fact that I like have a connection to America or that I was raised there. I think it's also very obvious with my accent. And the reason why on the podcast I call myself an Israeli is A, I didn't think about it. And B, a lot of the information that I'm bringing in is from my experience. I mainly work with Israeli communities. I mainly work with Israeli, you know, like educational communities or educational settings. The vast majority of my work is in Hebrew. And so then I think a lot of the information or nuance or Israeli perspective that I'm bringing in is as an Israeli. Now, of course, it's as an Israeli with a specific perspective, and I also grew up in the States. But when I speak Hebrew, I don't have an accent, or at least it's very. There's a few words, but it's very weak. And so I'm an Israeli having a conversation with Israelis, and I think that's very different than being an American having a conversation about the occupation. I think part of it is also my understanding that I was in the army. All of my political, the base perhaps of my political identity obviously goes farther back than from my 20s. But my political awakening and development on this issue was very much as an Israeli in Israeli society in Hebrew. I remember one time in 2014, it was even before the war in Gaza. I was doing a lot of work in these kind of like small grassroots organizations between Jewish and Palestinian citizens of Israel. And I also started working at this human rights organization called Gisha. I didn't have a very important job. I was like answering calls, but I was talking to people from Gaza on the phone all the time. Gisha is a legal center focused on freedom of movement to and from Gaza. And yeah, I mean, they do amazing work. And I think, especially now, their work is really, really important. But for me, I remember it was Yom Ha'atzma'ut, it was like Israeli Independence Day. And I just felt so, I don't know, overwhelmed by the big question of like, what do I think about the state? What do I think about the closure that we have on Gaza? I clearly felt very uncomfortable about it at that point, but identity-wise, I had been a soldier not that long ago. Most of my friends were really active in reserve duty, and I just remember we're supposed to go to a party, me and my girlfriend at the time, and I just sat on the ground in the middle of Rothschild, which is this like really nice street in Tel Aviv, and I just started crying. And she was like, "Why are you crying?" And I was like, "I don't know what I think about Zionism." And she was like, "But we're going to eat sushi." And and so it's definitely like, in no way am I trying to deny my Americanness or the uniqueness. And maybe it's not unique. I mean, there's a million of us here, which is obviously part of the settler colonialism part of it. And I think it's also a question, like, I've got a bunch of Palestinians to my Instagram who've said, "Do you think that you're a settler?" And I'm like, well, that's a really good question because my family's from Jerusalem. I think I have just as much right to be here as definitely as anyone, first of all. And I think the main issue is the system and not the people who are here. And I also don't shy away from the fact that a lot of Jews came here as refugees from Europe. Europe didn't want them. My family was in the Holocaust, but like Europe didn't want them. America had closed its gates at that point. There wasn't a lot of options. But the way the founding of the state and the way that the state structure was created and, the use of violence and the monopoly of violence that exists until today is inherently problematic. And of course, I recognize the irony of the fact that my grandmother is from Jerusalem and there are Palestinians today. I'm sure there is a Palestinian, if not living in Philly, then living in New York, then living on the East Coast, who her grandmother is from Jerusalem and I can be here and she can't. And I think that's inherently wrong. And I really understand, it's a place where a lot of times I've talked to a lot of fellow Jerusalemites who are Palestinian who have never been able to visit Jerusalem. And I think both from a religious perspective, but also from an identity perspective, that chills me to my bone that I'm able to come and live here and a Palestinian whose grandmother's from Jerusalem who didn't choose to leave, or even if her grandparents did choose to leave, that they can't come and be here. That's inherently wrong. That's inherently immoral. That's inherently obviously unequal. And I think, our society really has to reckon with that. And so I've gotten a lot of questions of are you a settler? And I think it's a really complex question. When I say settlers on my Instagram, I'm talking about 67 because my Instagram for the most part focuses on 67. And because I really am trying to use like legal language, right? Like Israelis aren't settlers from a legal perspective in Israel, and Israelis are settlers from a legal perspective in 1967. But obviously I understand like settler colonialism has a lot of legality to it, and that's not inherently the question that people are asking. And I think my answer is a cocktail of yes and no. But there's also the yes. There's also the reality that I was able to come, I was able to live here, I was able to join my family here. And despite having roots in Jerusalem, Palestinians can't do that. I don't think we're giving ourselves any we have to be able to have honest conversation. You know, if we really want to change and break down the systems and disrupt them and build better systems and build a better reality for the people who live here and the people who don't live here but deserve to be able to, then we have to be having an honest conversation about the rights and the access that we have.
I think that when you break it down to its simplest points and you try to speak about the situation of and the disparity between Israelis or Jewish Israelis and Palestinians between the river and the sea or in the old mandate or whatever we want to call it, this issue about residence and travel and freedom of movement that I am able to, having had no family ties that I know of, to make Aliyah. I am able to do that, whilst a Palestinian whose grandparent lives or grew up in Jaffa or in Jerusalem or in Haifa, they're not able to do that. That is the simplest distillation of it. And there is no way of denying that. You either think that that is not okay, or you think that it's okay, that that's what it should be, or that you don't see any better solution to it. With the point that you made about, and that I think is something that deserves to be the main sort of confrontation. Do you think that this person, whose grandparent came from this place that is now Israel, does not have the right to be there, as opposed to like Jews having the right of return, so to speak? But what you mentioned about labels, that's something that's particularly important to my opinion, that labels should serve practical purposes, not the other way around. I think that in a situation where movements for equality and justice, especially in the context of Israel-Palestine, are not able to secure real victories on the ground, there is sometimes a tendency towards retreating to the most aggressive language, the most provocative language. I mean, this is why I think on this podcast we don't play into these little things about like using Israel in quotation marks. Or like calling it Zionist entity, which has like its different historical implications when it comes to the use of Arab regimes of that label, and like it's just it's I find it personally just a little bit childish. You end up spending your time more on using like what is the true meaning of Zionism? Is there like one meaning of a word? And you withdraw from the area of what is actually happening to how does language work? Because the fact is that there isn't like definitions of words and practical meanings of words. They're not found like in nature. You won't find the true definition of Zionism hidden under a rock somewhere. People use different ways, different labels, and these labels are contested. And sometimes they win, sometimes they lose. They fall into obscurity. So with that in mind, and the discussion and point of, you know, your very emotional connection and thoughts on Zionism that you described. You used the word occupation in your title, so clearly that is something that you find important. You mentioned that you focus primarily on 67, but also recognize the nuance that comes from describing the connections to occupation in everywhere between the river and the sea. So why do you choose that word to be on? Why is it not Becker explains settler colonialism, or explains Zionism, or explains apartheid, or anything else? Why is it occupation that you decide to focus on?
That's a really good question. And actually, I was just kind of DMing about this with someone yesterday. I'm not sure that I have, you know, one specific reason. I will say that I myself am most active in the West Bank. Most of my political partners live in Masaf El Yatta, the South Hebron Hills, or in Hebron. And as I've said a bunch on my page, when I say occupation, I'm using the legal definition of occupation, which is 1967. But that's not to say that I'm not going to connect it back to issues that are going on in 48 that have to do with supremacy, right? Meaning the complete demolition of the Bedouin village, Umm al-Khiran, in the Nakab, Negev. That's inside Israel. And theoretically, the international community doesn't actually have a right to talk, like to have an opinion on it, right? The international community traditionally has the right to have an opinion on something happening in international grounds. But when we think about Palestinians in Israel, there's a really common thing that people talk about, which is the demographic threat. And, I think that as Jewish people, we inherently understand it more, even if we're not a part of that conversation, like the Jewish diaspora, I mean. But as Israelis, it's so common that it's in everyday language. I mean, it's really thrown around all of the time. I have a kid on his way in a month from now. The amount of doctors who have told us that we are fighting the demographic threat is horrifying. It really is. And my point there is that they're not only talking about Palestinians under occupation, they're also talking about Palestinian citizens of Israel, right? And when you look at the situation between the river to the sea, there's a fairly equal amount. There's around 7 million Israeli Jews and 7 million Palestinians. When you think of Palestinian citizens of Israel as Palestinians, which we should, because the differentiating between Palestinians in the West Bank, in Israel, in East Jerusalem, in Gaza, that's Israel's way of describing them. That's not how Palestinians describe themselves. The reason why I focus on 1967, though, and why I call it the occupation, because what's going on in 1967 is a clear case of legal occupation. The occupation at this point has also been deemed illegal, which it is not surprising by any means, as someone who deals with this on a daily basis. I think it also felt like, for me, it's really important to do work also with Israelis. That's also what I mainly do offline. Getting Israelis to say the word occupation or to consider the word occupation is already huge. So if I made a page and called it Becca Explains Apartheid, Becca Explains Settler Colonialism, and I do talk about these things with Israelis. I often tell them, guys, actually, settler colonialism is a much better situation than colonialism because this is our home. Overwhelmingly in settler colonialism, there's nowhere to go, and that's why it has this label. And w like we are going to stay. I use it as a way to say, actually, we can calm down for a moment and remember that we have a right to be here just by the fact that we're here. I don't mean that Israelis, of course, have a right to be on every piece of land in the West Bank or anywhere, but like as an overwhelming the like there's not going to be there, or at least there shouldn't be, a movement to kick out the 7 million Jewish Israelis that live here. But I think that using the word occupation is, for me, very important, because it still has an ability to get to Israelis. And also, and this is why I focus on occupation in general, the severity of the situation and the intensity of the situation in 1967 is generally much higher. Now, that's not to say that there's nothing going on in 1948 inside Israel, right? But the level of ethnic cleansing happening right now in Gaza and the West Bank is alarming. And so, if I can get people on that conversation, that's really important to me.
So I thought the point that you just raised of like the Israeli collective is not going to leave this land is something that I think is true, but is also somewhat contentious when you talk with like the wider anti-Zionist pro-Palestine movement, because obviously people have different opinions about what should happen. But that being said you do a lot of work in partnership with people in Masafe Yatta and Hebron. And I mean, I was involved in the 2023 May delegation for the Center for Jewish Nonviolence, which does a lot of work in that same exact region. And I was connected with some people, for example, I mean, we interviewed him on the episode I recorded during that delegation, Sam Stein, who currently lives in Umm Al-Khair, which is one of the villages in Masafer Yatta, and is very passionate about the fact that while he is a Jew, and even a religious Jew living in the West Bank, he is doing it in a way that I would say is objectively not a colonial way. It's not necessarily the mindset or the types of relationships that being a settler implies. And that also, I think, raises a lot of questions about what it means to be in like right relations with the land and the many different people that call it home. And a lot of the time, leftists often, or anti-Zionists often, single out Israelis as like the one identity group that has the most, that needs to like really seriously reflect on their relationship to settler colonial systems of power. And this is often done in a way that I would say does exceptionalize Israelis as like the quintessential settler. And that maybe isn't totally fair when white Americans like myself are also implicated in these settler colonial systems of power. It's just that the genocides, the ethnic cleansing have already been, I mean, not completed, but the most dramatic, most violent, most visible parts of it are in the past. And do you think it's fair to single out Israelis and as this quintessential settler? And what do you think the experience of being a Jew doing this kind of work in places like the West Bank can teach those of us living in other settler colonial nations or countries?
Yeah. No, I don't think we're the quintessential settlers. I think we're like, it's not that I think that the label of settler colonialism at all, it's not that I think that it doesn't apply. And when you, and it's also really important to say, when you see the ethnic cleansing of the West Bank, it really has characteristics of settler colonialism. I think in general, though, a lot of the conversation of settler colonialism, kind of going back to the words we use and the language, has become a discourse on an academic idea that actually does not, you know, Sam is living in Umm al-Khair. Sam is doing everything that he can right now to make sure that people can continue living in Umm al-Khair safely. And the community has invited him to live there. And people talking a lot of times in this conversation, and I'm not trying to be overly critical, but are really disconnected from what actually needs to happen to save Umm al-Khair. And Umm al-Khair is under real threat of expulsion right now. And I think, you know, we can spend hours talking about settler colonialism, about the meanings. Does it fit? Does it not fit? I want Umm al-Khair to stay put. And I want them to be safe. And they deserve it. And they don't deserve to have their homes destroyed. And they don't deserve to deal with violence on a daily basis. And a lot of times I think this conversation is, it's really disconnected. And so I think one of my biggest, I think about it, it's not really something that I spend that much time struggling with because it is what it is, but I do think it's a bit of a shame that one of the things that has come out of the current moment since October 7th is trying to pinpoint Israelis as exceptionalist, as opposed for other privileged groups like white Americans to actually look at their own historical parallels and modern parallels and say, how do we, what change do we need to do? Are we listening enough to indigenous voices? What does sovereignty mean? You know, what are the practices that are still in place that are harming indigenous people in the United States, right? Now, I don't even know the answers to that because it's not something that I'm, you know, it's not where I'm living. It's not where I'm focused on, but I do think that it's something that all of us should be thinking about and working on and amplifying those voices. And, you know, we're recording this and it's Thanksgiving. You know, Indigenous people in the U.S. have a lot of stuff to say about Thanksgiving, like, are we listening? And what instead it's come down to is this belief that Israelis are some sort of unique type of settler, unique type of evil, unique type of hates Palestinians. But actually, I, over the last years, have learned about South Africa, Algeria, Ireland, Northern Ireland, and actually a lot of the patterns are quite similar. That's not to say any of them are one for one, but there are certainly comparisons in a lot of these examples that can be made, which should be a good thing because it means also that we can step out of the current reality. There are actual roadmaps to doing so. And instead, a lot of the conversation is kind of turning Israelis into a specific evil. I think it's fun to like come on a podcast and then like usually I'm like talking about the occupation, but to kind of like defend, you know, to defend fellow Israelis. But I really do think that there is a it's a really unhelpful discourse. And I remember, you know, I posted a video at one point on my Instagram and I was talking about how I was talking to these soldiers in Hebron and like, they didn't know what the occupation was. And I asked them like, why are you standing here in Hebron and you're not standing somewhere in Israel? You're not standing somewhere in Jaffa, you know, like, they're like, oh, well, there's a lot of Arabs in Hebron. I'm like, well, there's a lot of Arabs in Jaffa. Like, so why are you here and not there? Now, it's not that I think that the army should be in Jaffa, yeah, that no one listens to this and thinks that that's what I'm suggesting. But I mean, we're probably, unfortunately, not that far away from that reality. But how is, you know, how, what does the occupation look like? And I just, like, I put this video out to say, like, you know, we're indoctrinated, we're taught really specific things. Fear is used very well. There is a lot of effort being put into Israelis to not know what is going on in the occupation. People don't believe the occupation is as bad as it is. People believe that Israeli soldiers do nothing, are totally passive, until like there's some, you know, major security issue. And not that Israeli soldiers are constantly making kind of our presence felt in places like the West Bank and in different ways in Gaza and East Jerusalem, so that Palestinians will never lift their heads up, right? I mean, that kind of basic reality is just not felt. And where I really feel it a lot of times on social media is people saying like, oh, if I, you know, like white Americans for the most part saying, if I was Israeli, I never would have gone to the dance festival next to an open air prison, right? I would never join the army. But the reality is yes, you would. You know, I say this as someone who I spend my whole entire life trying to get people to be more critical on this issue and to not just be critical, but to take action, you know, to go into the West Bank, to organize, to create relationships, to follow Palestinian leadership, to create the future that we want to see. And it's incredibly hard. And on for people, it hits them when people go through a political process here. It's a huge emotional process. I don't think it compares to like the daily violence the Palestinians go through, but it's a really, really hard thing for someone to go up against almost everything the narrative of their society says that is being constantly pushed. And the echo chamber is never, it's non-ending, you know, it goes on forever. And then I just think it's a real missed opportunity for people to basically take this situation and say, where is this applicable to us? What can we do about this? How can we be better organizers? How can we be a better society? How can we change? How can we rethink sovereignty? You know? And so I think that's really missing. And I think any situation, if you were to take, you know, and I say this to Israelis on the opposite. Israelis will try and say October 7th was anti-Semitic, right? But actually, I think that if October 7th happened and Israel was not a Jewish nation, but a Christian nation, all the other conditions were exactly the same conditions, I really don't think October 7th would have looked differently, right? And so I don't think so, which means that there's not a uniqueness, but that non-uniqueness goes to both ways, right? The violence isn't unique, and I'm a nonviolent activist. It's, you know, it's not how I choose, though of course I participated in violence in the army, and that's what brought me to this place. But also there's not a uniqueness about Israelis in a settler colonial state in which our government, state, and military control 7 million Palestinians, right? I think it's we need to reframe it, and we can learn a lot.
You mentioned earlier that you won't be too critical on some perspectives that you mentioned. I am. I think it's important to make the point every now and then, just as a matter of making it clear it's not the first time. I think it's possible, and there's a logic behind an argument that Israeli settler colonialism is different from American or Canadian or Australian, or to pick a non-English speaking language country, Swedish settler colonialism. Because it is ongoing and because of its scale and because of the violence that is being perpetrated right now and not, you know, decades in the past. Although I think you should also be careful with that, because some indigenous activists in places like North Dakota might have something to say about that. However, to somehow make this to be a point that would support the idea of the mass removal of Israelis, because they wouldn't leave peacefully, is it's anti-human. It doesn't help in any situation. It doesn't help any sort of discourse. There is no good nationalism, whether it be empowered or disempowered. There is no good nationalism. This is a point that Jewish socialists, including Heinrich Ehrlich of the Bund, of course, made in the interwar period about Zionism. There is nothing that would help in this situation. This is when you have when you are talking about processes of decolonization or anti-racism or anti-imperialism, these have to talk about the specifics of the systems and not the people or the nationalities they come from, because they don't help the minoritized groups. I feel very strongly about this. I think that this is something that you can take from general humanist principles. I really feel strongly about this. I die on this hill, and I take this consistently because I wrote my undergraduate dissertation on the fate of the Germans in Poland after World War II. Who were ethnically cleansed and treated in a horrible, horrible way. A significant part of Poland after the world, after World War II was western regions of Poland were taken from Germany in compensation for areas of eastern Poland that were annexed by the Soviet Union. And Germans that lived in these territories, whether they were Nazi sympathizers, Nazis actively participating, anti-Nazis, they were ethnically cleansed. And their culture and language was treated in a terrible way, and many people died in that way. And to somehow, and this was framed in this time as like a liberatory revenge against the Huns, who, of course, you know, we know what the fate of, even without speaking about the Holocaust, the fate of the Polish population during World War II, that this was somehow, you know, retribution for all of that. I think that this is something that you can, you have to take this from an anti-nationalist perspective, per se, and the processes that speak about nationalism and colonialism and racism. And you have to tackle the institutions and the relations on the ground, not the people themselves. Now, does that mean that like everyone in, especially if you're talking about the occupation and settlements and such, are able to stay in this same situation? No, but to somehow talk about some sort of fantasy of like returning to the pre-1948 status, it's, you know, even in the situation of Palestinians being able to return to their homes, there are way more Palestinians that exist today in diaspora than there were at the time. Of course, they're not all going to go to the exact same places where they came from, to the same houses, because there are so many descendants that come from here. And so when we talk about these issues, when we talk about these issues from a humanist, we approach things based on general principles about what we believe the best thing for humanity is, not that this is a good nationality and this is a bad nationality, which is a very significant point in any sort of understanding of the world that a progressive, a leftist, a socialist perspective should take. You need to talk about, first and foremost, practical solutions. How do we actually get things done on the ground, and not about what can we do in terms of hypothesizing about things that will, for the record, never happen. Never happen. It's not even worth considering the idea that, oh, what if they all leave? Or what if, like, the moon falls into the earth? Like, it's, what if? It's not, to even go down that perspective is already, you're lost in the source. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say, just because I think that it's particularly important to emphasize that every once in a while. But in terms of bringing this back into the discussion that we have, so just to bring it back into the discussion that we have, in terms of practical solutions, there is one of the problems. There was recently an organization in an Israeli-Palestinian organization that came to Standing Together Vienna, which is not officially affiliated with Standing Together. I'm not going to mention their name if they don't wish to, but people can look it up. That talked about the difficulty that exists in joint Israeli-Palestinian places at this point when it comes to travel permits. How do you even get these conversations done? We're going to, I think, also mention before the end, I want to also mention this point about what does it mean to work with Israelis and what are the values and limitations. I'm sure a lot of people have critical points there. But if you're talking about the occupation, then the centering of Palestinian voices and experiences is certainly something that needs to happen. And so even now, as a person who's actively involved on the ground, I think it would be very interesting to hear your view in whatever you can disclose, because of course, that's also something to take into account. How do these relationships, how does this organizing work happen on the ground, and to break that barrier that exists between Israelis, and specifically Jewish Israelis and Palestinians?
So I would say that most of the organizing happens in Palestinian spaces, which I actually think is fantastic. It is a pretty big barrier for a lot of Israelis, but it also means that the Israelis who self-filter through and come are willing to be in Palestinian spaces, are willing to listen to Palestinian leadership. And of course, on one hand, we're partners. We work together, we think together, we brainstorm together. And on the other hand, if there's an action happening in Hebron or a demolition happening in Umm el-Khair, the people who live there are the ones who have to lead it. And that's incredibly important that it's not our space to go in and make those decisions. And I'll even say more about that. I think that for me, the experience of organizing, especially in the South Hebron Hills, has been very humbling because you really have to understand what's your limits and what are your values and where do you stand when there are inherent disagreements. And probably the best example that I can come up with is gender separation. I think that as a lot of Israeli leftists, you know, right now there's this whole issue of ultra-Orthodox enlisting or not enlisting. And there's a lot of talk amongst Israeli leftists of how do we support not enlisting ultra-Orthodox, because we don't want to put a band-aid on the occupation so that there's enough soldiers to uphold it. We want to end the occupation, right? And at this point, it's quite hypothetical. I mean, it's not actually something that's on the ground, which I think is a problem. It kind of shows how far away we are from each other. But well, are we willing to work with these same ultra-Orthodox communities who are really for gender separation in the public sphere? And my answer is that I think that we should, because Palestinians that I have been working with in the South Hebron Hills for a long time, different villages are different, but some of the villages are very, very strict about gender separation to the point where I don't think it's totally accurate to say that women are people with free choices. At the same time, the occupation also harms those women. And working with the men of the village also helps to protect the men, to protect the women, to protect the family. And also, I think as Israelis, it's not exactly my position to go into a village and tell them, even though I disagree, how they should deal with their reality of gender relations. But I do think it's my place as an Israeli to go in and say, I don't think we should allow demolitions to happen. I think we should take a stand. And I actually think that that's brought me to a place where I think also, you know, I don't quite consider to be myself in the same society as ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel. We're part of a larger society together, but we're literally not sharing spaces. At the same time, I think that we have to be able to find a way forward to be able to organize together in a way that makes sense. And sometimes that means making concessions tactically that personally I think could make sense to make. But a lot of other Jewish Israelis really, really strongly disagree with me, right? Like, I'm sure if there's ever a Jewish Israeli listening to this podcast, you know, a lot of people think that the issue of gender separation is even bigger than that. But back to Palestinian Jewish organizing, a lot of it's really then happening in those spaces. And I think that that is a great thing, because the thing that I love about it is, you know, it's a lot of resistance. It's a lot of going with shepherds and making sure that they're not attacked, or if they are attacked, trying to like calm down the situation and de-escalate and call the army and stuff like that. But you're also building relationships, you're also sharing food together, you know, things that don't necessarily sound super political. But if we want to view a shared reality in the future, how are we going to make a shared reality if in nowhere we have some sort of shared presence? We don't really bring Palestinians into, at least in the work that I do personally, don't really bring Palestinians into Israel. It's almost impossible at this point, which is in and of itself a problem. But I also think that there's a proper level of humbling in going in, you know, people invite you into your homes, they tell you your story, they tell you your opinion. For me, the most important thing inside of this organizing when I work with Jewish Israelis is not just to bring difficult sob stories, but rather to bring voices of people who will challenge Israelis. I remember once sitting with a group in the educational bookshop, which is in East Jerusalem, with Mahmoud Muna, who is one of the two owners and is a brilliant human. And I remember the conversation that we had afterwards, and one of the Israelis said, I couldn't dismiss him because I didn't feel bad for him. I felt uncomfortable because he was challenging me, you know? And I think that that's something that we need to try and create spaces of solidarity and not sympathy. And going into Palestinian spaces at least somewhat changes, they obviously don't change the main power dynamic, but it's humbling in my experience. And I think there's a way we need to find more of it. And I think that there's also, you know, probably the group who's doing the most work on this inside Israel is Hadash, the Arab Jewish Communist Party. And I have a lot of respect for like their youth groups and general. And I think that's something that's actually also quite missing within 48, Jewish Palestinian co-organizing and still recognizing that if it's on an issue that has to do with Palestinian citizens of Israel, allowing it to be Palestinian led.
I would like to talk a little bit about like the specifics of the organizing that is taking place, because I was talking to someone, Rabbi Chell, who's a really wonderful left-wing rabbi we have where I live. And one thing that they said in regard to this moment is that they really don't think bringing Jews, and I'm going to problematize this binary later, Jews from diaspora should be going, making a long trip to Israel in order to engage in this kind of work right now, because it's not a really good use of our resources. Because at the end of the day, I end up having to raise money just for the plane tickets. And it's not really worthwhile necessarily just to get people to come there for a couple weeks, a month, maybe at most a few months, and then come back, when actually it's really important for people that are doing this work to really be rooted there for a long enough time that it's not like, I hate using like a cost benefit analysis language. It's really dumb to be using this in regard to movement work, but it's not really worth the cost. And instead we should be focusing on supporting and uplifting the kind of work that, say, like All That's Left or Combatants for Peace, maybe, or Jordan Valley Activists, uplifting the groups that are doing the work on the ground. Tayush, yeah, one of the older organizations doing this work. Or even, perhaps more controversially, Omdim Biachad, Standing Together, that has pretty notably, and I would say problematically, been added to like a list of normalizationist organizations by the central organization of BDS. And I was wondering what you make of the sort of movement ecosystem and how you see its limitations, where it could be stronger. I'm aware a lot of these organizations are pretty geographically narrow in scope. Maybe they focus on the Jordan Valley or Musafer Yatta, but not on the wider 67 occupied territories, or of course the whole from the river to the sea. And what limitations do you see there? How can we be supporting this work? Is there any development towards like a wider coalition of these organizations? What are things looking like right now?
Yeah. So I would say that, first of all, on the ground, for as horrible as things are, I actually think that the movement is getting stronger. It's a bit smaller than it was before October 7th. Like you kind of see activism, like left activism here, comes in waves. In like 2009 or so, with Anarchists Against the Wall, there was kind of this height of a wave, and some of the original dispossession in Sheikh Jarrah and Sirwan, a lot of it, which was the families were saved back then. And then it kind of went down. And I think the reason being is that movements here are not very good at building sustainability. So people basically come in, get really burnt out, and then drop out. And you still have like old time activists from, you know, Anarchists Against the Wall that like still go to the West Bank on Fridays. And I find them to be very impressive that they've been doing it for so long, but the majority of people don't.
Another argument against Israeli particularism, the lack of structures on the left.
The lack of structures on the left is really horrible. And I talk about it a lot. And I also helped found a group called Midrash Edol, which means Freedom School, which, when I say it in English, sounds really funny to me, but it's a nice name in Hebrew. The whole point of it is we were a group of around 9 Israeli activists who were saying, what didn't we have when we were politicized? What didn't we have when we started crossing the green line and going into the West Bank? How do we create more sustainable community so that the struggle can be stronger? And I think it's important to say, and every time there's a new group, you know, every couple of months, and we meet them, and one of the first things that I say to them is, I don't care if you up until this moment voted Labor and now you're voting Chadash, the Jewish Arab Communist Party. I don't care. What I care is that the movement can be sustainable and can grow. The thought about creating this program was to strengthen the movement. It wasn't to strengthen individuals' political positions. It wasn't to get them vote more left, right? It's that we need more people on the ground, actually. And so that's where we put kind of all of our effort in. And I do think that that's one of the things that has helped to make the movement grow a bit. But also, I really see that at this time, the original model in the South Hebron Hills for doing a lot of this on-the-ground protective presence for a while was only happening in the South Hebron Hills. There had also been a group once upon a time in Jerusalem, and that wasn't active for years. Now it is active again. They're called B'nai Avraham. But also, you can really see the difference in the Jordan Valley. Jordan Valley activists didn't exist 5 years ago. Some of the areas didn't even exist really like 2 years ago. And so the fact that today there's a fairly stable stream. It's still too small. We need more, but it's a fairly stable stream of activists going into the West Bank is incredibly important. And it's even more important because now the government is starting to crack down on international activists in the West Bank. And so I actually think it's great that international activists come. It is a real question, though, of how long are you coming for and what's your commitment? Because we also really need those resources. We need to be able to have money to pay for gas to people to go out. And honestly, you know, there's this belief that leftists are like being paid to like to have these opinions, basically to go out and protest and be paid. But honestly, if people were able to actually have time for it and resources for it, then the movement would benefit. And I don't think we should be embarrassed to say that. And I do think that Israelis can learn a lot from diaspora communities. And this is what I take as someone who grew up in the diaspora. When I would learn about struggles that Jewish people that I saw participate in or that had historically participated in, I think there's a level of understanding that this benefits us. Maybe I'm completely misreading the history of this, but I've now done a few learning seminars of activists on the civil rights movement. And the impression that I get from the Jewish people who participated in it was not just that there was a level of solidarity to it, which of course can't be denied, but that also a lot of Jewish people understood that this benefits us in the long term because stronger minority rights benefits everyone, including Jews as a minority. And as Israelis, we, and this is why these movements come and then and break down after a while and then have to be rebuilt and break down, is because we're really working exclusively from a place of solidarity and exclusively from a place of guilt. I'm not talking about every individual, but it's a real issue. And when you talk to leftist Jewish Israelis who only have ever lived in Israel, it's something that comes up a lot. And I do think where we can benefit a lot from the diaspora is actually creating more sustainable struggles. I think we're getting better at it, but I think we still have a lot to learn. And the other thing that I think that we really actually do need the diaspora for is going back to a lot of these conversations of will Israelis be forced to leave en masse and like the use of the word Zionism and even the use of the word settler colonialism, is that I do think it's really helpful to have Jewish diaspora come spend a significant amount of time here. Like if you're going to come to do one action, don't do it. Don't raise $40,000 to come do one action. Like really, we don't need that. I'm sorry. It's not a good use of money, but come spend time in the West Bank, make relationships. You can bring those relationships with Palestinians back. You no longer need someone like me to make the connection, which I'm happy to make, but I don't want to have to make it in the sense that these connections shouldn't just be going through us, and go back and help explain what the situation on the ground is, right? I don't see any value in spending a class in a university talking about settler colonialism and Israel if in the end, Nassau can't stay in his home in Susia. They feel incredibly disconnected to me. And I think also, though, take that time and come here and spend time organizing also together with leftist Jewish Israelis, because we're also often kind of, I think at this moment, not completely part of the conversation. And I actually think that we have a lot to bring into the conversation. I think that we are very good at creating relationships that are difficult to maintain, in which we don't necessarily always align, in which we're trying to create a little bit of a wider bridge, but for a very clear shared purpose. I think especially when it comes to the conversations that are happening abroad, there is also a place to listen to leftist Jewish Israelis especially and figure out how to make us part of the global left. If we can't be a part of the global left, then I actually think there is a, maybe not if we can't be, but I think this is really showing the actual difficulty in the world of kind of the left movement at this time, which is that when it's not convenient to have a left movement in there, we'll dismiss it. And I think that actually leftist Israelis together, I think with Palestinian citizens of Israel, are going to be one of the main bridges when we build the next day. And we need to be building that day right now.
I think part of the difficulty of that is actually encapsulated in the title of your most recent podcast, which is Where is the Opposition? I think when you look at the Knesset, it's just like you have Chadash Ta'al. That's pretty much the only like left party that is even represented in the Knesset. And even they aren't perfect. I have seen like they still kind of uphold a two-state model. And I think given that you acknowledge there's like a one-state reality, I think there needs to be like a deep introspection of, is that even the most possible outcome that can be a just settlement?
Yeah. Though I will say in defense of Chadash, I'm not a member of Chadash, but I will say that I think, and this is, I think, very different. Like they see a two-state solution as a genuine answer to an existing problem, and not because of some right of the state of Israel to exist. And I think that it's an important kind of differentiation, because I do think that the two-state model, while I don't totally see how it's possible on the ground, what I really think Chadash is doing is they're saying, we agree there's two people here. We recognize Palestinian existence. Like 80% of Hadash is Palestinian also, maybe even more. And we are fighting for that existence. And I think when you see their actions in the Knesset, they're fighting the occupation. I often tell liberal Zionists who want a two-state solution in the US, your party that actually represents what you want is Hadash. But because they're actively left and actively fighting for it, a lot of times, you know, liberal Zionists won't actually work with them because they're considered to be too left. And then I'm saying, okay, so what you're really just doing is passively supporting the continued one-state reality. And like, let's separate those things.
I mean, I think you can make a principled argument that the establishment of a Palestinian state, so a two-state solution recognized on the international arena, can be a prerequisite to some sort of confederal, federal, binational, one-state future reality, simply because it gives Palestinians that voice on the international arena, the institutions as such. I think that's a consistent argument, and sort of the divide of do you want two-state or do you want one-state as like a binary is, no pun intended, a little bit tiring. A lot of the stuff that you say, it grounds me in the vision of, it's not a question of getting a majority of Jewish Israelis to realize that settler colonialism is wrong, because that's not what the question was.
That's never going to happen.
That's never going to happen. That wasn't the question in South Africa. That wasn't the question in the Deep South or in the colonial world. However, I think it's as equally foolish to believe that you can have a liberatory movement for Palestinians without some kind of Jewish Israeli active strong presence within it.
Absolutely.
If you're not including that in your vision, you're just thinking in abstracts of what you personally think ideally would be, but it's not connected to any sort of possible reality on the ground. And also what you talk about allyship, I like this differentiation. I mentioned this in the previous episode, actually, about allyship and coalition. I won't repeat the spiel just now, but there are ways. I think there is also a way, of course, time and place, but a way of saying, yes, the primary victims, by far the primary victims of the Israeli political system and state and governance as it has been since the founding of the state have been Palestinians, of course, 100%. However, at the same time, you can have a socialist or humanist critique of how the state of Israel impacts Jews and Jewish culture, identity, nationalism, chauvinism, militarism, in the way in which Israel is soaked through thoroughly, and that is damaging both within the diaspora and for Jews in Israel. That also is connected to it, and you can make those sorts of comparisons, even talking about various socioeconomic issues. Israel is not the cheapest country to live in many ways.
No, it's not. Definitely not.
It's far from the sort of Scandinavian welfare state as it liked to be portrayed for the first few decades of its existence, even socialist in some perspectives. There are significant reasons as to why people who are struggling socioeconomically, often from Sephardic or Mizrahi backgrounds in Israel, turn to right-wing extremist movements and nationalism, because that's the thing that they are being pushed towards in many different ways, especially if they are isolated from any sort of international leftist organizing.
Yeah, I just want to add 2 points to that. Today I was sitting with a friend, won't give her a whole background, not mine to tell, but she is a child of a migrant worker in Israel. She's not Jewish. And she's very critical of how Israel deals with Palestinians, how Israel controls Palestinians. And she says, like, a lot of the people who kind of threw her under the bus, or a lot of the people who are the most gung-ho Zionists in her surrounding, are fellow children of immigrants who have status. One of the main ways to get status is to join the army. And I was just texting with someone else who's not Israeli, but has friends in Israel. And she was saying, I think that the systems of occupation and even how the state functions is horrible. But when I talk to my family on the phone, I'm talking to these Israelis who feel disempowered. Now, I think there's some things to be said of the feeling is not necessarily the complete truth always, right? Like, Jewish Israelis are not disempowered in the way that Palestinians are disempowered. We have access between the river to the sea. We currently can't visit Gaza, but settlers are starting to. And also, that's an Israeli law. That's not a Palestinian law. Whereas Palestinians, their access completely depends on where they were born, which completely depends on where their grandparents ran to or didn't run to in 1948 and 1949. But I think that in the end, and this is really important, there is a regime here. There's a state. It's using means of violence, first and foremost, to control Palestinians so that Jewish Israelis don't feel it. Like, have a level of control and amount of violence on Palestinians so that Israelis don't feel it on a daily basis. That's now been thrown out the door. It's always going to come to head because you can't control people indefinitely and expect that it won't lead to a fairly large amount of violence, including towards the privileged people. And now we're seeing a lot more use of violence against Jewish Israelis. I mean, the police is led by Ben-Gvir. Ben-Gvir, he wasn't born there, but he was basically grew up in Kiryat Arba, where he was literally above the law. Ben-Gvir, who today is the head of the police, how is it surprising that the police is now using that violence on Israelis? And I think that my friend was right, that the average Israeli is also disempowered. Again, I'm not comparing it to the way that Palestinians are, but within our ability, you know, most Israelis don't want to build settlements in Gaza right now. It's just not interesting to people. It's not something that people want. And almost definitely there are going to be settlements in Gaza because it's really hard to actually influence power. And I think that's something that we're seeing globally. And so I think that it is really important to remember that the principal victim of the occupation and even just kind of like the Jewish supremacy that exists are Palestinians. But in the end of the day, once you have supremacy and you have state apparatus in which the state is then trying to maintain its power and control, as opposed to using that apparatus to protect its people, that is going to come back on the people. And that's exactly what's happening here. And I think that Israelis, they're maybe not jumping to say, let's end the occupation, but also almost all the Israelis I've talked to this year, including really right-wing Israelis, very much agree that things cannot keep going this way. It's not functioning and that there needs to be a major change. Do they understand what that change has to be? Not necessarily, but there's definitely no question that this violence is felt within Jewish Israeli society. And again, you see that throughout the world in unequal conflicts. It starts by putting it on them, but it always comes back around to us. I think we're seeing that very clearly.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the colonial boomerang. If you're going to be violent,
yeah, exactly.
Eventually that violence is going to come back. That enemy is one of choice. And I mean, what you just kind of said sounded almost like what Jabotinsky said about the iron wall of course, if we're politically the aggressor, colonized people has never just let their land be colonized without a fight. And that has always been internalized within revisionist Zionism. And the rest of the Zionist movement just kind of ignored that.
Yeah.
That's a big part of why at this point, the revisionist Zionism has been dominant for 50 years because they're the ones that really looked at the reality of, hey, we are colonizing another people. We can't just imagine that that's going to happen in harmony. That never has happened in history.
Yeah.
We're about around time, and I want to ask one more important question. Some of the things that have struck me throughout this conversation, post-October 7th, a lot of people in the anti-Zionist movement were using like Algeria as a metaphor. And I think there's something about it that's just not the same, because Algeria had a France that was the metropole. And if there is a metropole for the Israeli settler colony, it would be the Jewish diaspora, arguably the American diaspora of Jewish people, first and foremost. That's just not the same. There is not a country that's ready to absorb these people, and people aren't just going to flee in mass, because a lot of people who have been born in Israel, they don't have any other land. That also brings me to the next thing I wanted to say, which is I watched this film, No Other Land, which was filmed in Masafer Yatta and is about the struggle against the evictions. And that was a really hard film to watch. It's kind of hard to find right now, but I think if you get an opportunity to go to a screening, it's a really, really hard-hitting film. And I'm excited that we're able to put on a screening at my own synagogue, which I think is going to be really impactful. But in it, there was a conversation between one of the directors, two of the directors, Hamdan and Yuval, where he says, basically, how can we be friends when the person that is demolishing my home could be your friend or your cousin? Like, how can we make this sustainable? And I think by bringing it to that really human relationship level, it really encapsulates some of the difficulties, but also the importance of the kind of co-resistant solidarity work that that film's about, because otherwise you can't just start this out of nowhere. And the fact that people have been doing this for decades is foundational to creating a movement. If this movement hadn't existed before, it's not like something we could just make out of thin air right now. So I think it's so important to uplift the people that are doing this work and say, actually, like, we need this work. It's the only thing that might make an impact on Israeli society, and actually allow Palestinians who are completely disempowered, especially in 67 territories, to give them people that can speak for them. And of course, there's challenges. There's a certain amount of it that could be seen as a savior complex, and that's always important to be checking.
For sure.
Even parts in that film that I'm like, oh, someone could interpret it that way. And it made me even feel somewhat complicit in having attended the CJNV delegation, which I think is worth it, though it should be longer and they have other programs I'd say are better. But it does make you feel very uncomfortable about some of the ways that whiteness appears in these spaces. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about is the binary between Israel and diaspora that we've used several times in this conversation. And one thing that Rabbi David Cooper raised up during that delegation actually was that he believes that we shouldn't be seeing it as a binary, that actually we should be seeing Israeli Jews as part of diaspora as opposed to separate from it. And I think that is actually objectively true, because most Jews in that land were displaced from other lands within the last 100, 200 years. By contrasting diaspora and Israel, it perhaps normalizes the idea of Jews as being quote-unquote indigenous to that land, rather than this is just another place that Jews live. And also by thinking about it as part of diaspora, I think it raises interesting questions about what self-determination for the Jewish people can mean, because it can bring us back to the idea of Jews being dispersed throughout the world and not necessarily needing a demographic majority somewhere to feel safe and secure. And it also raises a very difficult question of what would it mean to transform the Zionist Jewish community in Israel to a diasporist community that doesn't feel a need to claim exclusive territorial control over the land, doesn't feel the need to dominate it, doesn't feel the need to be an ongoing settler colonial project, but instead can actually participate within a decolonial process that doesn't necessarily involve all the Jews leaving, but instead joining in coalition with Palestinians for a just future. I mean, the phrase I've seen at some of the anti-occupation bloc protests is "from the river to the sea, justice and equality." And I really like that phrase because, one, the way that "from the river to the sea" has been claimed as hateful speech when we've already discussed it, it's nonsense. But to focus just like this is a geographical bounds and we're focusing on justice and equality for all, I think has particular resonance. I was just wondering if you could say how this idea of, rather than seeing these as a binary, of seeing it as part of the diaspora might sit with you, and any reflections you might have wrapping up this conversation.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I haven't thought about it exactly in those terms before, but I think there's certainly a case to be made. I mean, I think that one of the things that is really present with me at this time is that a lot of Israelis are leaving Israel for a multitude of reasons. Definitely a lot of the left community has left, unfortunately, but also just like high-tech doctors, there's a brain drain happening right now. And the feeling is if we can escape war, and I think most particularly actually a combo of war and the bad economic situation and live somewhere else, then let's do that. We actually don't need to be the sole sovereign. We can be a citizen of another country. And at the same time, today I didn't read the article, I just saw the title saying that some Jews in Amsterdam are now thinking about moving to Israel following the Maccabi game and the attacks that happened. It really made me think about how much Jews in the diaspora use Israel as a security check. You know, I think we assume that people want freedom, but I actually think the people who are moving here, I wonder, do they realize a lot of the civil rights that they're about to give up in order to be in a place that prioritizes them? But again, we're really moving towards a reality in which that prioritization is assuming you agree with the regime. I'm not sure that everyone moving here, I hear a lot of people moving here because of waves of anti-Semitism or because of the reaction of people on October 7th around the world. And inherently, you're coming to a place where the use of violence here is also very problematic. Now, like, you know, the rise in anti-Semitism is also problematic. And then I think, you know, once upon a time, 150 years ago or whenever, now I've like lost count of when the Zionist movement started, you know, the 1880s, the idea was that Zionism, you know, a politically sovereign Jewish state, will solve the reality of anti-Semitism, but it hasn't.
Arguably, it's actually reinforced it.
Yeah.
Especially with like its racial aspects, seeing Jews as an other that has a separate homeland from the places we live.
And to an extent that also existed before, right? I mean, like there was a lot of anti-Semitism that revolved around, you don't deserve to live here before the Zionist movement was created. But then they said, okay, this can fix that problem. And I think at its core, the state of Israel cannot fix that problem. And I think that's something that both Israelis and diaspora Jews, and here I think we really are the same, have to grapple with. We have to realize the way to ensure our safety is to live in places in which we are ensuring really strong democratic regimes or really strong regimes that have minority rights, that have more participation rather than less participation of the people, that don't have a consolidation of power. And I think the diaspora understands that better in terms of their own lives, and yet still wants Israel as a security check. We're afraid to be a minority. We inherently understand that it's bad when there is a lack of minority rights, but also we do want to be the majority over here. I think that in a lot of ways, it's the same issue, and we're just on different places of the axis in terms of the issue. In that sense, I do think that it's a Jewish question. Like, it's a question of the Jewish people. It was a major question during pogroms in Europe. That was one of the things that led to the Zionist movement in the first place. And it's a major question today in 2024, you know? And I don't think that it belongs more to the diaspora or more to Israeli Jews, but I do think that there's a lot to give to each other in trying to answer that. I think there's no question that Jewish Israelis will continue living on this land indefinitely. And I personally get really offended when people do the whole go back to Poland thing, because one of my really good friends, her grandmother was tortured by Mengele, her and her twin sister. And she can't get Polish citizenship because they destroyed the paperwork that shows that she was born there, you know? And it's a really unhelpful conversation, I think. In addition to that, I also think that as Jewish Israelis, we have to understand that supremacy is not the way. To me, that actually feels more crucial than the specific framework of settler colonialism, because you have supremacy in places that are not necessarily settler colonialism, but there's still supremacy. And I think there's a lot of parallels that we can take from those places as well. Some of them were, of course, affected by colonialism. You know, it's hard to talk about India and Pakistan without talking about supremacy. And it's hard to talk about India, Pakistan without talking about colonialism, but it's not settler colonialism. So I think it's a real question we have to understand of dealing with that question of supremacy and reopening that question of what actually are our needs? What do we need in order to have strong communities? What do we actually need for safety? What do we do now that democracies are clearly not so democratic anymore and are consolidating power throughout the world, right? And the answer can't just be, let's go to another place that's doing exactly that. And so I think that's where I absolutely think that Jewish Israelis in the diaspora need to be having a conversation. I think the only place that's happening, unfortunately, are at these yearly Zionist conferences, and we probably need to be creating alternative spaces to be having them, but to be having them thoughtfully and open-mindedly.
No, I do think one thing that also came up as I was watching the film No Other Land was at one point Yuval was asked, where are you from? And he said, I'm from Be'er Sheva. And they're like, oh, you're Palestinian. And he was like, no, he said Yahud. And they translated Yahud to Israeli. But I was like, Yahud, as far as I'm aware, is Jew.
Is Jewish. And, yeah, but it's very common.
But it's very interesting to me as someone looking at this society from the outside of, oh, I can see that there is a distinction between Jewish and Israeli. But especially for secular Israelis, they might not even see that these are separate things. You aren't necessarily a Israeli just because you're Jewish, and you're not necessarily Jewish just because you're an Israeli. And of course, this speaks to like a ethnocentric nationalism rather than like a more civic nationalism that, of course, puts the Palestinian citizens below in terms of like a hierarchy of citizenships. And I guess it just makes me think about both the difficulties of the moment we're in and like the real stakes of the crisis within Jewish identity that we're facing.
Yeah.
But also the possibilities of what could actually be of people really wrestling with this. I mean, Yisrael literally means to wrestle with God.
And to wrestle with God.
It's one thing to just kind of take it for granted that all Israelis are necessarily Zionist, but if they were to like actually study Jewish history and look at the fact that like, hey, we've been a minoritized people for most of our history, and actually we've thrived. Of course, anti-Semitism's been a check on that, but we have truly thrived all over the world. We've created communities that have created all forms of culture and language and built relationships with people both in our communities and outside of our communities. But then I feel like a certain degree of that is lost when you just kind of flatten the grand narrative. And just to kind of take us back to where we started, I do see a fundamental part of diasporism being its reliance on personal and family histories as opposed to grand historical narratives. And I feel like I did a program when I was 17 that was like a semester in Israel through the URJ, and it took like a Jewish history course that started in the Torah.
That's the same one that I did.
Okay, when
I
was so here, you're familiar. When I was here at 17. It's a grand historical narrative that starts in the Torah, goes up to like Bar Kokhba, which is when Jews were resisting against the Romans and then lost and were displaced. And then all of a sudden we skipped 1700 years and we got to Herzl and we're like, oh, what happened during these 1700 years? Doesn't matter. We're in Europe all of a sudden and talking about returning to our homeland, in scare quotes for both of those terms.
Yeah.
And it's just very interesting to think about the possibilities of what like a deeper Jewish history could provide for the people in this land, because it does arguably pull a very different message, narrative about our place in the world as a people and the way that we're supposed to be relating to the ger, to the other, to the quote-unquote strangers. And of course, Avraham was all about an open tent and welcoming the strangers, but it feels like they've become so divorced from that mythos, from that also history, that it almost is a people that have completely forgotten who they are. And that's deeply sad. And I think it really is important for us to be actually challenging that and to be in dialogue with the people that are in the society, because if we're not actively engaging and seeking to win hearts and minds through the kind of work that you're doing, through Breaking the Silence and through Becca Explains the Occupation, people are not going to get to really see the impact of Zionist practice on the land as it exists today, but also the way it shapes our understanding of what it means for us to be Jewish.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I really agree with a lot of that. I think, you know, it obviously depends on the community here. I actually think Sephardic and Mizrahi communities still have a lot more Jewish practice, including people who theoretically define themselves as secular, they're misalti, like they don't keep Shabbat, if you will. They don't necessarily keep halacha. But I do think that it's something that we also know has been really kind of pushed down as part of our narrative. And I often say, maybe I'll finish with this, but like I'm in this conversation a lot with my partner who is Israeli from Tel Aviv. And I often joke that like, she's Israeli and I'm Jewish. Or like, she's Israeli and I'm Jewish Israeli. And I actually think my first years living in Israel, when I was really like, I wasn't more Israeli then than I am today, but I was in the heart of the narrative. I gave up a lot of my connection to Judaism, because you really can come here and replace Jewish thought, feeling, identity with being Israeli. And becoming engaged in anti-occupation work also gave me a lot of space to continue, you know, to obviously still have my Israeli identity. And, you know, my Jerusalem identity was always there. Like it was, you know, always a part, but also kind of bring my Jewish identity back in. And it's constantly gotten stronger over the years. And, you know, now that we're about to have a son, there's also a lot of questions of assuming that we're here. How do I raise him with a strong Jewish identity in a way that is not necessarily one for one the identity of the state? When you go to public school, you learn all of the holidays, you learn what it is to be Jewish, but you don't learn what it is to be Jewish in the way that I learned what it is to be Jewish. And I see them to an extent as related but separate identities, in which a lot of times the Israeli identity, it's not that it doesn't involve Judaism, but it's turned Judaism often for secular Israelis into something very specific. And of course, there's diversity there. I don't want to say that there's not, but it really is a question that I have right now of how do I raise my son as, on one hand, an Israeli, and on another hand, as a diaspora Jew in Israel? And, you know, I think, again, it goes back to this axis of we actually really need to be in conversation, and there's a lot that we can bring each other.
Absolutely. I think it's really important for us to be able to think through the differences of how we interpret what it means for us to be Jewish. And I mean, a big part of what you just said of the transformation of what it means to be Jewish is actually why a lot of Haredi Jews were historically, and many still are, anti or non-Zionist, because they resent the way that Jewish identity has been diluted of its spiritual and religious character and instead been turned into a secular nationalism.
Right.
And I would say a diasporist cultural, even political Jewish identity at this point is similar to that, but also I'd say very different in the types of culture that it upholds, the rejection of any like monolithic understanding of Jewish culture, and instead embracing the true pluralism of all the different Jewish languages and identities that have existed, and embracing the fact that these still do exist, or at least many of them still do exist, and we should be focusing on the revitalization and a renaissance of Jewish culture across the board, rejecting any one monolithic understanding of what it means to be Jewish. And it's very important to be in dialogue with Israeli society, because otherwise we really can only make an impact on, I'm going to again use the binary idea of diaspora Jews, when in reality we need to be in dialogue with Jews in Israel in order for them to see what frankly we can see, but a lot of Jews in Israel have a really hard time seeing, because they're so rooted and immersed in this society that is so toxically supremacist and so high on its own supply that you can just become so deluded about the possibilities that we can dredge up, hold on to, and embrace.
Yeah, I think it's also a mutual growth. Like, I think there's also a lot for the diaspora to gain from Jewish Israelis. Obviously, Jewish people in America got to America mainly because of violence through things like pogroms, but also to an extent economic viability.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas most Ashkenazi Jews in Israel have grandparents who were in the Holocaust. America more or less closed their gates at that point. Mm-hmm. And of course, most of the world's Mizrahi Jews live in Israel. And I think that it's a both and. I think Israeli Jews, obviously, that we need to kind of break down our supremacy, right? And I think that's something that we can really take from diaspora Jews. And I also think that diaspora Jews can take from Israeli Jews the more recent lived experience, overwhelmingly, I know it's not one for one, but overwhelmingly of displacement.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two major things throughout our histories that we can really benefit from each other, from learning and gaining. And I think in the end of the day, there's a lot of Jewish communities and we have a real ability here to expand our tent.
Absolutely. We could talk for hours and I'm sure we'd still not run out of conversations and topics. And I'm sure some people listening to this are not going to be satisfied by questions that we missed or stuff like that. And I think it's really important that people know where to find you. So could you tell us where to find you?
Yeah. So my Instagram page is called Becca Explains the Occupation. And I also have a podcast now that's actually Zoom calls once a month. So I post them on Instagram. You're welcome to join and then you can ask questions. But then I turn it into a podcast for people who can't be there. And of course, I do my best to kind of keep my DMs open because the whole purpose is for it to be an educational page. So people should feel free to follow and to send questions or to disagree or whatever it is. I'm here for it.
I'm really grateful for the resource that you provide. I think it's a really good entry point for people that are just starting to question. And I think the focus on bringing Israelis into seeing this perspective and seeing the facts on the ground is super important and often neglected by people within the wider movement. Really grateful for all the work you do. And I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Great talking to you.
Thanks for having me. And until the next conversation.
We are beautiful. We sing.